Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The economy has taken the worst hit in generations as the result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Unemployment is at Great Depression levels. Retailers are in crisis. Some have already declared bankruptcy. The federal and state governments have been devising strategies to provide some income to those businesses that have closed and to individuals who suddenly lost jobs during mandated stay-at-home orders. But more is needed. We haven't yet conquered the virus that caused all of this, nor are we likely to in the near future, but because of our dire economic condition, states are already reopening their economies. And people are wondering how quickly we can come back from all of this. How much damage has been done? How much more damaging to any economic recovery would a serious spike in cases be if they result from opening things up too fast? Well, many hope that if we can turn things around quickly, we can resume what just a few weeks ago was the most robust economy in modern times. And with over 900,000 North Carolinians out of a job and with similar statistics around the country, the sense of urgency is palpable. We spend time this hour talking about that with Mark Vintner, senior economist at Wells Fargo. Welcome back, Mark. Good to see you.
Good to be back.
Dr. John Connaughton is with us. He is the Barings Professor of Financial Economics and Director of the Barings UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. It's good to see you again as well, John.
Good to be here, Mike.
And Heather Long is with us. She's economics correspondent at the Washington Post. Good morning to you. So, Mark, I'm going to start with you because the last time you were here, I think it was St. Patrick's Day. It was just after the great stock market crash. The Dow had its worst day since 1929 on the day you were here, the day after that. We were still doing the show in our studio where things work. but now things have changed. We're in the ninth week of the shutdown. I asked you then if you thought that pent-up demand would result in a burgeoning economy once the stay-at-home orders were lifted. And you said that one thing that might allow that to happen was that all the economic fundamentals going into the COVID-19 pandemic were sound. There was nothing in the economy to worry about, no excesses. Do you still feel that way, and are you still that optimistic?
Well, I mean, I don't know if that's optimistic. There were no excesses in the economy that would contribute to a financial crisis. And what I meant by that is housing wasn't overbuilt. Commercial construction wasn't overbuilt. And so we weren't likely to see lending contract in a way that would give us, that would make it very difficult to engender a recovery. But I don't know that we're going to have a strong recovery from this, because we can't really get back to the pace that we saw previously until either the virus tones down to a point that folks aren't worried about it, or we have a vaccine and folks aren't worried about it. And neither of those things are likely to happen for a year or more. So it's going to be a very gradual grind back, and it'll probably be I describe it as kind of a bumpy Nike swoosh, so that we had a Nike swoosh recovery from the last three recessions, which meant it took a long time to get back to where we were. But this time it's likely to be bumpy because we don't know what's going to happen with the virus, if we're going to see a second wave when we get to the fall or probably the winter.
And John Connaughton, I know that at least the last thing I read from you was that you believe there will be a lot of pent-up demand when this is all over. In what sectors do you think you'll see that? Are you talking about retail pent-up demand by consumers or other areas?
No, I don't think that's actually retail. I think is in trouble. But, Mike, I want to make a slight little correction. I don't think that we're actually going to – I agree with Mark on this. I don't think there's going to be a quick recovery. This thing's gone longer than I think originally we expected it to. And I want to clarify a couple of things that are really not a lot of people are talking about right now. We had an unemployment rate in April of 14.7%. When the May number comes out, it's going to shock a lot of people. Okay. But there was something in the April number or the April release that didn't get a lot of press. And that is the, in the commissioner's statement, he basically said that the unemployment rate is 14.7%, but it really is 5 percentage points higher, 19.7%, because there are about 8 million people that are not being counted as unemployed, but they are also not at work. All right. And that is an unusual large number. They did not adjust for that number. But if you read the commissioner's statement, you get the whole drift of it. So essentially that 14.7% rate is really 19.7. And we've had another 14.5 million people since then file initial claims for unemployment. So in the March, when the May number comes out, it's going to be 25%. In reality, it's going to be 20% published, but it's going to be 25% because of the people that are on PPP. And so what's happening there is most of those jobs aren't coming back. All right. They're in the service industry. The hard hit sectors are hospitality, leisure, other services, except retail trade. Those jobs aren't coming back. And so while there'll be some pent up demand from all of us who are working online, you know, 20% of the workforce isn't getting their jobs back anytime soon. Certainly not this year. As Mark said, until either the virus decides it one takes a day off or until we have some kind of vaccine, which, you know, is a ways away.
Just to prove that Heather Long from the Washington Post is here, she wants to comment on that. Go ahead, Heather.
All right, I'll jump in. We're in a critical period right now. June and July are really key months. And a big part of what's going to determine how fast this recovery is how many businesses close permanently. As I've already reported, we've seen about 150,000 small businesses close their doors forever. And how many people get back to work? We're already starting to see consumer behavior change. So people I've talked to who've lost their jobs in Florida, for instance, in the tourism industry. I talked to a woman recently in the Florida Panhandle. She has put her home for sale on the market because she not only doesn't think she can make her mortgage payments possibly this summer, but she doesn't think she'll be getting back to work. And so when people are starting to vote with their feet like that, that is her signaling that she doesn't think she's going to be middle class by the end of this year. She thinks she's going to drop out of that. And so we're starting to see, you know, these types of behaviors change when people put their homes up for sale. And when, and so that kind of fear, it's really a question of a fear factor in the fall, both fear that a virus could come back or fear that people are going to lose their jobs. And that's what holds back. Sure, there'll be some pent up demand. My hair is really long. I can't wait to get somebody to help me to cut it nicely. But that doesn't mean, even with that pent up demand, that we're going to be back at 100%, that we're going to be back where we were in February. And if you look at China, which is kind of a couple of months ahead of us in this process, even now, their demand, their pent-up demand, if you will, has bounced back a little bit, but they're still at about 50% of where they were pre-pandemic on consumer spending.
Yeah, Mark, you said, I'm not sure when you told me this, but I think it was the last time you were on, that it takes twice as long to recover as the length of the downturn. So as John Connaughton said, we've been in this longer than I think most people thought we would be in it, and we're going to be in it a while longer. So what are you saying about the recovery, how long that might take?
Well, in this particular instance, it's unusual in that the downturn may actually be behind us in terms of the drop in economic activity. Tom Barkin talked about this yesterday as the president of the Richmond Fed, that we may have already seen all of the drop in aggregate economic activity. So it may have been 3 months. I don't think that we're going to recover in six, though. So I think it's going to be a much longer recovery because the drop was so severe. But with businesses reopening now and reopening in May, all of the daily tracking numbers that we're seeing are going to be higher in the month of June than they were in the month of May. So we're actually going to see the economy begin to grow in June. But I don't think that old rule of thumb that it takes twice as long as twice the length of the decline to get back to where we were. In this case, I think it's probably going to be about 3 months of a very sharp decline, followed by about 2 years of a very gradual recovery.
So you're seeing not a V-shape, but a U-shape recovery. And I know one of the things that you've written about, Heather, is fears of a W-shaped recovery. And I guess that would be something that happens if we have a resurgence of the virus in the summer or the fall or whenever in the winter, perhaps. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, that's certainly the biggest fear of all, that we'd have to go through all of this again, go through another lockdown, go through another shutdown. But the other part that people forget, the other thing that could cause some sort of a W, you know, a second downturn, is if we have a huge wave of bankruptcies, both businesses going out, going belly up and closing doors forever, and individuals not being able to pay their bills. I think it's really critical. One of the numbers I pay the closest attention to is, unemployment, the real rate is probably around 20% right now. But the scarier number to me is most economists are predicting that sort of a year from now, we're still going to be at 10% unemployment. So sure, that means quite a few people go back to work in the next year, but we would still have, you know, over 15 million Americans, 1 in 10 unemployed, potentially a year from now. And that's going to hold people back.
John Connaughton, Heather mentioned that about 150,000 small businesses have already shut their doors forever in this pandemic. I don't know what the number is, and maybe you don't either, but maybe you do, in North Carolina. And I'm curious as to why, because this PPP, all these pieces of legislation that allegedly pumped trillions of dollars into the economy and into small businesses, were supposed to prevent that from happening. It didn't work.
Well, you know, it's not clear who's got it. We don't have the transparency yet in terms of how much. There's a lot of complaints about particularly small businesses not having the relationship with the bank that was, in fact, administering PPP loans. You know, that's part of the problem. I mean, mostly it's the big banks, and small businesses don't tend to have relationships with those banks. Mark can speak to this a little bit better, but I've also heard that a lot of these loans have been very slow going out because of essentially money laundering regulations, and being able to verify that this won't come back to bite the bank long term. But I want to kind of highlight something that Heather mentioned about, you know, the length of the people, businesses going out of business, if you will. I think that's the big shakeout from this that I don't think that when we started into this that people fully appreciated. I think it was like, okay, we're going to take 2 months off and then everything's going to go back to normal. Everybody's going to go back to their job. Let's take a restaurant, for example. Even as they start to open up, they're not going to hire all their people back for any time in the near future, because they're going to be very limited in terms of social distancing, if they can serve inside or not. You know, all those things are going to be an issue. And so even when they start back, if they didn't go out of business, they're still going to be looking at 50%, 60% staffing. And so all those people aren't going to get a job, get their jobs back instantaneously. One last thing. The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, has suggested that we're going to see a potentially 35 to 40% decline in GDP. Now, I got to be careful about that, because that's an annualized rate. So that's more like 10% decline in the second quarter.
John Connaughton is the Barings Professor of Financial Economics and the Director of the Barings UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast, the official forecast of North Carolina. Mark Vitner's here from Wells Fargo. Heather Long from the Washington Post. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post, John Connaughton with UNC Charlotte, an economist there, Mark Vitner, the senior economist with Wells Fargo, about the economy right now in this COVID-19 pandemic. It seems that we underestimated what was going to happen in the 2 months that we were going to have this unplanned vacation nationwide, and the recovery may be slower and more painful than we initially thought. As we speak today, all 50 states will have begun the reopening process. And many say that the reopening process is happening despite the fact that most, I think all but two states, have not met the White House's own recommendations for how to calculate when to reopen. So we have businesses coming online. We have restaurants opening their doors. We have parks and beaches that have opened. It appears in many of those locations, social distancing is not being practiced. People are not wearing masks. We haven't conquered this virus. Heather, are we setting ourselves up for failure?
Well, it's certainly not where the medical community would like us to be in terms of what people are doing. I can see it in my own neighborhood here in Washington, D.C., where certainly when I go out for my evening walk, a lot of people are no longer wearing masks. Really, the only place in D.C. that you consistently see masks is the grocery store. And that's because you are technically not allowed in a grocery store in Washington, D.C. without a mask. They have, you know, guards that stand out and check people on the way in. So, I think, you know, what I'm really watching kind of going forward from here is, I think, how many people get back to work. What's interesting is we were talking just a minute before the break about small businesses. You know, Congress has passed almost $700 billion worth of aid to small businesses. That's record amounts of aid from the government. But there was one key problem with that. And that is most of the money was supposed to go to 75% is supposed to go to pay workers. And Congress's heart was probably in the right place. They wanted to get workers back to work as the economy reopened. But what we're hearing from so many business owners is that the math doesn't work like that. The reality is most of their costs, or at least a good portion of their costs, are on fixed expenses like rent. And if they can't pay their June rent or their July rent, they're going to go out of business forever, and they will not be able to hire those workers back.
Why does the government not know that? Why did policymakers and Congress people not know that? Why does a government headed by a businessman president not know that?
I think it's a problem that's very specific to micro businesses. This is a problem for businesses that are 15 people and fewer, because the reality is they don't have a ton of people on their payroll, and that's why their overhead costs can easily be half of their expenses. The good news is I'm finally hearing some bipartisan chatter here in Washington, D.C. last evening and this morning, where Republicans and Democrats in the House, at least, seem to want to do something potentially next week to try to change this ratio of having to spend the money in 8 weeks and having to potentially spend 75% only on salaries.
Part of the problem, as I understand it, Mark, was a lot of the money, it had to go through banks, and a lot of the banks tended to give the money quickly to big business and not so quickly to small business, and they're the ones that are hurting the most and the ones that have the lowest amount of cash on hand to stay in business while their doors are closed. Is that accurate?
Well, that's somewhat. I mean, the definition of small business varies considerably. I mean, is it firms that employ fewer than 500 workers? Is it firms that have less than 200 million in sales? Most people would think of small businesses as something that has 2 to 3 million in sales. But if you're an audiovisual company, or if you're a heating and air conditioning company that installs a lot of high value equipment, your sales are going to be real high, but you're still a small business. And so, you know, I think that was part of the issue. And then also, at least in the initial round of it, they wanted banks to be able to, they went through the largest providers of small business lending. And they said, well, the banks know their customer, and that way they would be able to get the money out relatively quickly. Not only did they encourage, not only did it go through banks, but they encourage you to go to your own bank that would have information on you. And so the second round loosened that up, and they've also included non-bank providers as well. You know, I think that in terms of a big government policy, this actually was done pretty well, even though we've had all sorts of issues with it. In terms of how it was targeted, how quickly the money got out there, this was remarkable. And it's not surprising that we've had some problems with it. I would think that that Treasury would have some authority to change the rules, but they may not, but they should have some authority, because they could. A lot of this comes down to what the tax liability is going to be. And so they should be able to reinterpret those rules and set out some definitions. The IRS is always been kind of slow in getting those out. But I know that a lot of companies are looking at this, and larger companies are better positioned to say, well, you know what, if we can't get this as a grant, getting this as a low rate loan is still relatively attractive. It's going to provide a lot of help for the economy. But one of the things that we missed the first round was the micro small businesses, the smaller small businesses that didn't have audited returns. They didn't have the financial statements needed to qualify for the loans, and they couldn't put them together quick enough in order to get that first round of funding.
Dr. Connaughton, Heather just mentioned that in her reporting that she's hearing some talk in Washington about the Congress coming together and putting together more help. And Fed Chair Jerome Powell testified, I think it was yesterday, with Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, before Congress, and he was on 60 Minutes in a pretty lengthy interview on Sunday night, in which he was, I think, for a Fed chair, uncharacteristically vocal about the need for the government to put more money in people's hands. And he said that on 60 Minutes that if they don't, we're in for a long, painful downturn. Do you agree? And do you think that's what's lighting a fire in D.C. under lawmakers?
Basically, I agree with that. But if we look back at some of the things the Fed has said, Fed chairs have said in the past, like Janet Yellen, she always wants to throw the football over to Congress to spend the money as opposed to the Fed doing things. But having said that, we've already spent pretty close to $3 trillion in the first 8 to 10 weeks of this pandemic and downturn in the economy. I know the House passed a bill the other day that was another $3 trillion. We can argue the merits of whether or not all of that $3 trillion is going to help. But at some point in time, we're going to run out of money. And we're going to run out of ability to put together packages to borrow money to prop up the economy. I think that we've seen a number of well-intentioned but not necessarily effective policies put in place in the first $3 trillion that went out. And for example, from what I understand, Heather, you probably know this better than I, but from what I understand, the money that was set aside for the airlines still hasn't made it to the airlines yet. And so, you know, there's talk of at least one or maybe more of the nation's airlines going out of business before the end of this year. So I think that we've got to be real careful that thinking somehow or other that the government can bail us out of this this downturn and the severity of this downturn.
Well on Sunday on 60 Minutes, Powell said that now is the time for the government to spend money to keep businesses and individuals afloat, and he said it will help us get out of this. And money right now, he said, and these are his words, is cheap. We have that and time, he said, on our side. There will be time, he said, to figure out how to pay all of this back. Well, given the national debt that we have and the deficit spending that we've been engaging in for a long time now, when the bill comes due, what will it be like? I don't even know which one of you to ask that question of.
You know, I think that it's going to be pretty substantial. For starters, higher taxes. Government's going to have to find a way to partner with the private sector to provide a lot of services that we are currently getting from the government. In terms of education, there's going to have to be much more e-learning that's going to be going on a permanent basis. We're going to have to reduce headcount in government by a substantial margin. And restructure retirement and healthcare benefits. I mean, these are all huge things that are going to take place, and there's really no way around it because of we basically taken the federal budget deficit to where we thought it was going to be 50 years from now, and we're going to have to come to terms with that in the aftermath. But now is really not the time to worry about it. I agree with John that I do think that the federal government needs to keep their powder dry, and realize that they need to be well targeted, and they need this recovery could be we're hoping it's going to be 18 months to 2 years. It could be much longer than that, and so they need to be judicious in how they they lay out stimulus. And I got to tell you, you know, there's a lot of talk about whether they're going to cover the bad debts for some of the states that are really highly indebted. I don't even think that's really much of an issue because I don't think they're going to come close to it. We're talking about covering 50 to 75% of the added costs of COVID for state governments at most. I mean, that's about all the federal government can do. So they're not going to be able to bail out any states.
So we have unemployment right now, Heather, at Great Depression levels. And I mentioned 900,000 people in North Carolina who are unemployed. I think over a million have filed for unemployment. Right now, I think the unemployment rate is 20%. John said earlier that it's probably going to be much alarmingly higher when the next set of numbers come out. And the Fed chair believes it could go as high as 25%. Does that make reopening this economy all that much more important? The quicker we do it, the better we do it, because the longer we wait, these jobs will be less likely to come back. Is that a calculation we can make?
It's a delicate balance. Obviously, if we get people back too soon and we have another spike and we have to shut things down again, then we're back at 20% unemployment. So that's the scenario everyone's hoping and trying to avoid. But you're right. We have economic evidence and studies, certainly from the Great Recession, that tell us the longer that people are out of work, the more likely that those temporary job losses become permanent. And we're already starting to see that. I've been keeping in touch with dozens of workers across the country, a number of whom, particularly in places like spas and hotels. You know, when we first talked in March, they told me it's just temporary. I've been furloughed. I still have my health insurance. Yeah, I'm not going to get paid for a while, but I'm going to apply for unemployment aid from the government. I think I'm going to make it. I'll be back to work this summer. Now I'm getting heart-wrenching texts from people who are telling me, remember when I told you I was just furloughed? I've just received notice that my health insurance will end at the end of May. And then I am permanently laid off. And so the more that starts to change from a temporary to a permanent layoff, the deeper the scarring becomes. And that's what Fed Chair Powell was really trying to warn in terms of what we're going to see going forward.
So if we keep being told, and we have been told in the past, that small business is the backbone of the economy. More people work for small businesses than they do for great big businesses. So if 100,000 businesses have already shut their doors forever and more are to come, do we have to fundamentally rethink how this economy works? And how long does that take?
Mark. I don't know. That's a pretty big issue to tackle in terms of. I mean, I do think that a free market capitalist based system has proven to be the best system for providing opportunity for people and lifting people out of poverty. That's been shown around the world. It's worked better than any other system that's in place. That has ever been put into place, but certainly, you know, we have areas where opportunities have not been as fairly distributed, and we should find ways to expand the pool of opportunity. But I don't think that we're going to have a total remake of capitalism. The government's role in the economy is going to be larger for some period of time. But in the aftermath of this, I think it's going to shrink because we're not going to be able to afford to pay for that.
Well, what I was talking about is not a switch from capitalism to something else, some alternative economic system. but if it is the small businesses who are bearing the brunt of what's going on right now, and the policies and money that's been put into the system to help them is not effective at the moment and may not ever be to the degree that it is needed. Going forward, when we get out of this, are we going to have to rethink the kinds of help available to small businesses as opposed to big businesses? Because they seem to get the lion's share of everything. So are we going to see that happening? Are we going to see a push for that to happen from the thousands, the millions of people who work and run these small businesses? Heather, anybody, John, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I mean, I wrote a front page story on this last week, and I think there is definitely a case to be made that the power shift between big and small business in the United States is going to further shift in the direction of big business because of this pandemic. And it was already starting to happen in the years after the Great Recession. And a lot of politicians use the talking line that, oh, you know, over half of the jobs in this country come from small business. That's not true anymore. That was true in the 80s. That was true in the 90s. But the latest data from 2017 is 47% of people were employed by small business. And by small business, I mean business with 500 or fewer employees. So the bulk of Americans were already working at big businesses. And we're probably going to see even more of that shift to more workers being employed by big business and more consolidation in industries than what we were seeing after the Great Recession. And my biggest concern, if I could just finish one thought, you know, yes, we could do more aid to small business, but the biggest concern is Mark's talking about capitalism and our dynamic system. The reality is we weren't very dynamic coming out of the Great Recession. Startups and new business formation in this country was anemic. It was at a 30-year low. And if we really think of ourselves as a dynamic economy, we need to find ways to get people to take risk again and start businesses when we come out of this.
But why would you take a risk? Why we pay all this lip service to the importance of entrepreneurs, and they're the ones being left in the dirt. Why would you take that risk?
Well,
go to work for IBM. I only have 20 seconds.
I mean, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs have been in the tech sector, and their businesses started with one or two people, and they grew to be thousands of people. So it is not necessarily that, you know, we've had a lot of gazelles in the tech sector. So, you know, I do think there was some dynamism, but it was heavily concentrated in the tech sector.
We have to stop. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the state of the economy and where we are headed as we begin to try to come out of this COVID-19 shutdown. Heather Long joins us. She's an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Mark Vittner is senior economist at Wells Fargo. And Dr. John Connaughton is the keeper of the economic forecast for North Carolina, the Barings UNC Charlotte economic forecast, and a professor of economics at UNC Charlotte. John, how we've been talking about small businesses, how dependent economically, is North Carolina, is Charlotte, on small business?
Don't think it's that much difference than what Heather mentioned. The latest numbers are 47% of employment. But Mike, I think that what I'd like to do now, if you'll give me a minute, is talk about some scenarios of how this may play out over the next couple of years.
Okay.
Heather talked about the W recovery. I think that's the thing that scares us the most. And it's one of the reasons why I think the Congress needs to leave some powder dry for that possibility. We've seen a lot of people talk about governors not opening up economies fast enough, et cetera. And I don't think that's as big an issue as we'd like to make it out to be, because the real issue here is whether or not people feel comfortable getting back and actually going to these businesses when they open up. So the hair salon may open up, Heather. But are you going to be willing to go there to essentially let somebody cut your hair that you don't really know that well? So there's a lot of that going on. So let me give you a couple of scenarios as to how this is going to work. Right now, for the last week or so, we've been cranking out about 20,000 cases, new cases a day. And we've just gotten down for the last 5 days to around 1,000 deaths per day. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I think that may, in fact, be the best case scenario. It's kind of cold to talk about it that way going forward over the next several months. If, in fact, that continues on and we don't have a spike in the summer or in the early fall, it's quite possible that by the end of this year, we could be back down around 10-12% unemployment. And that would set us up, if we get a vaccine in the winter, that would set us up for a recovery that would probably take us through mid-2022, another basically 18 months after that, to get back to the GDP we had in the fourth quarter of 2019. That's the best case scenario that I see out there. The middle ground is, what Heather talked about, and that's the W economy, that we are recovery, that we have some kind of a spike somewhere late summer, middle summer, maybe in the fall, or even next winter before the vaccine becomes available. And we get set back. And so we're whittling down, we're putting people back to work, but then the second shoe falls and all of a sudden we're back at 20% unemployment again in the wintertime next year. And a number of states have to shut down for 8, 10, 12 weeks like they did this year. And that's all bets are off. And that's when we really need to have the government be able to step in and really support people. Not necessarily businesses. They're long gone by that second wave. Okay. But we need them to be able to support people with extended unemployment insurance and health care. So well, just let me finish one real quick, Mike. I hate to be a dour on this, but I think we need to be realistic about what we're looking at going forward.
That brings up an email from one of our listeners, Ted, who says, is income replacement via direct payments to consumers a good solution to jumpstart the economy? This has been deployed across Europe, but would it work in the United States? Who wants to take the answer to that?
I'll be happy to, because I think I know who Ted is.
Okay.
It might be a colleague of mine. I think that is something we need to consider once we get this thing opened up and we start to realize we have long-term permanent unemployed people. I think we need to be looking at that in order for those folks to begin to participate in the economy.
Heather, you also wanted to take a shot at that. Go ahead.
I think this is hands down the biggest regret in Washington. Even Republican senators like Josh Hawley in of Missouri will tell you that they wish that the United States had done what the UK and Denmark did and pay companies directly to keep workers on the payroll.
So Is it too late?
It is too late in the sense that some businesses already have closed and we already have, 36 million Americans who've applied for unemployment. Those job losses have happened in the United States. It didn't have to happen.
I want to get back to something that you alluded to a little while ago, Heather, when you were talking about the woman in Miami, I think it was Miami, who was going to put her house on the market because she felt that she was slipping out of the middle class. And you've written a whole article about people worrying now and, in fact, slipping out of the middle class and perhaps forever falling into poverty. If this begins to happen on a larger scale than just one woman in Miami selling her house because she's afraid that she might fall out of the middle class, are we likely to see changes in our social safety net? Because cracks have been showing up all over our economy works when it works. When it doesn't work, it really doesn't work for people. So are we going to see changes in our social safety net?
I sure hope so. I mean, if anything has shown us how big those holes are, I think both holes in terms of who can qualify for these programs like unemployment. Now we've got so many self-employed people and gig workers. They usually don't qualify for uninsurance. Congress had to write a special package in for them. But also, you know, we have not well funded the technology systems to get this money out. We're sitting in a digital age when I can Venmo you 10 bucks here in like 5 seconds. And yet we've gone 2 months without getting some of these unemployed people a check yet or getting them a digital payment. That is crazy in 2020 because those programs are literally running on 1970s technology. So I think both of those have really come home to roost, unfortunately.
But the picture you painted, Mark, is that we're about to run out of money. So if we change we can't increase our social safety net, meaning health care and automatic payments to people who may be out of jobs or all kinds of things that are showing cracks in our system. Well, we won't be able to afford to do that, will we?
Well, I mean, we're already running massive budget deficits. And the question is, we don't really know at what point we push that too far. And right now, I would argue that we do need to be exploring some of those things, but we have to figure out a way to know what is going to be sustainable and what is going to be temporary. And we can't just have larger and larger budget deficits. We are going to have to finance this over some period of time. There will ultimately be a price to be paid for all the money that's being created from the monetization of the debt. It's not going to be a hyperinflation, but we are going to have higher inflation over the 10 years after we move past this than we did during the 10 years prior. So there's some real limits, but we do need to explore ideas such as Milton Friedman's negative income tax, which is basically being modernized after being brought back 30 years later. But I do think that there's prospects for that. I just don't know how much relief it's going to provide for us right in the very near term.
So we all Americans have short memories, but let me remind you that in February, we were riding high, economically speaking. There was no problem in sight anywhere, and we were, as the president likes to say, we had the best economy in the history of the world. I don't know if that's hyperbole or whether that's actually true, but it was pretty darn good. And suddenly, without warning, bam, we are in the Great Depression 2.0. What is the effect of that, John Connaughton, on people's psyches going forward? We can't trust anything to be what it seems to be.
Well, I'd like to say about two or three things to wrap up a couple of what people I think should take away from this. We remember Donald Rumsfeld when he was Secretary of Defense and he paraphrased the Johari window, the known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. Well, this was an unknown unknown, and he always said that those were the things that come back to bite you. But two things about this recession that are fundamentally different from every other recession that any of us have experienced or even read about in this country. One, this recession is backwards. And what I mean by that is all our lives, economists have understood that unemployment is a lagging indicator. Tell me GDP today, I'll tell you what unemployment's going to be 6 months from now. Well, now unemployment and job losses are leading the decline. It's a leading indicator. That's number one. That's different. Number two, something that occurred this time that has not happened before, and that is the burden of this recession has fallen unduly on one group of people. If you look at the April employment statistics, we saw the average weekly wage hourly wage jump by over $10. What that tells me is lower income people were the ones who lost all their jobs, and all of the folks that work at banks and educational institutions and newspapers kept their jobs. Okay. And so there's been a completely different effect in terms of the who got hurt and who bears the burden of this recession versus previous recessions. Back in the Great Recession, lots of people lost their jobs, the whole strata, lower income, upper income, bankers, lawyers, lots of people lost their jobs. This time it's been isolated to basically the folks that work in small businesses in the service industry. Go to any strip mall, you can see where those businesses are, who lost their jobs, who's not there anymore.
Is that why I think it's a former Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, has said that comparing what we're going through now to the Great Depression or even the Great Recession is not accurate? Is that why?
Absolutely.
We have a comment on our website referring to what I just said seconds ago. You say a few months ago our national and local economies were in tip-top shape. What about the widening income and wealth gap, the corporate debt load, the impacts of climate disruption, the failed healthcare system, the waste of funds on international aggression, and the bloated war budget? To blame a poorly managed outbreak for all the crimes and failures of an outdated economic system is a massive and cruel ruse. The debt bubble was due to burst, and oil price collapse could have done it even without a pandemic.
I can address that with one simple thought. All of those problems existed prior to January and February. All those problems existed a year prior, 2 years prior, 3 years prior, 4 years prior. So, it doesn't take away from the fact that even with all of those issues, we had a 3.5% unemployment rate. We were adding jobs across a broader sector of the economy than we'd ever seen. And that prior to this crisis, the fastest wage growth was actually at the lower end of the spectrum. Now, that's where we were seeing the wage spectrum. That's where we were seeing the strongest wage growth. So it's reversed awfully quick. But yes, the economy was pretty good in January and February. There's really no way of taking away from that. We're never going to finish that to-do list on everything that we need to solve in the world. But we were in pretty good shape prior to this.
We've said many times, and economists have told me many times on this program, that the stock market is not the economy and vice versa. And the stock market took this major hit when this first started, but it's beginning, it started to come back almost immediately. It's not where it was prior to this COVID-19 outbreak, but nonetheless, it hasn't collapsed like the economy. And Heather, you say that Wall Street usually rebounds a lot faster than Main Street, and that it's still not pricing in full optimism. Should it be? And if it did, what would it take to get back to our all-time highs?
Well, it sounds like it would take a vaccine to get back to the all-time highs.
Okay.
I've certainly seen the market rallied. I think the last few days on Moderna, I think the latest drug. I'm probably saying it wrong. I'm not the medical expert. But the way I look at it is like this. In March, when you and Mark were last talking, the stock market was down 30% from its all-time highs. Today, sitting here, we're down about 16% from that February high. So we've made up about half the losses. Why did that happen? Partly, it is optimism about reopening and potential vaccines. But more so, it's really the Federal Reserve, that unprecedented amount of money the government has poured, both Congress and the Federal Reserve, into stabilizing markets and into helping particularly large businesses and a good number of small. That's a lot of corporate money aid, and Wall Street like that.
Like everything else in our world today, everything is very partisan and it's seen through a partisan lens. And today is the first day that every state in the union has begun to reopen at least a part of their economy. And many people are warning that we're doing things much too fast for all the reasons that we've talked about, the potential of this W-shaped recovery as opposed to a V or a U-shaped recovery. When you talk to people in D.C., Heather, in Washington, policymakers and others, are they talking about the balancing act between safety, human safety, and the safety of our economy? How do you balance the risk of people losing their lives with the risk of people permanently losing their livelihoods?
This is the hottest topic of conversation, and you could see it yesterday in the hearing with the Treasury Secretary and the senators, particularly the Democratic senators, going back and forth on, asking the Treasury Secretary that, are we costing lives to reopen this economy? And are we costing lives every time we would go to a restaurant or every time we would get a hamburger? And those are really, really hard questions to answer right now. So I think the biggest question on my mind, we're going from triage mode of the economy. We were in triage in March and April. Now we're beginning to reopen. But the deep questions that are being asked right now are really, what does this economy look like when it comes out of all of this? We are not going back to February. We are not going back to that normal. More people will work from home. Potentially people will leave bigger cities like New York and come potentially to places like Charlotte, what are known as second tier cities. We're going to change so much. This is the biggest shakeup in American life and economy in most of our lifetimes, bigger than 9/11, bigger than the Great Recession. So much is going to change policy-wise and how we live our daily lives. And I think people are just beginning to grapple with that. And certainly everyone I talk to who's working on who's working on President Trump's reelection campaign or Joe Biden's reelection potential campaign are grappling with what are those policies.
And you get the last word. Heather Long is economics correspondent for The Washington Post. She joined us along with Dr. John Connaughton from UNC Charlotte, the keeper of the Barings UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast, and Mark Vittner, a senior economist at Wells Fargo. Thank you all for the hour. Stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.